Hi there, and welcome to One on One. On today's episode, it is the third part of our three-part series where we look at influential members from the media within German football. Today, I'm very excited to welcome our guest, being Jonathan Harding. Jonathan Harding himself works for DW and does a fantastic job covering not only the Bundesliga, but the German national team. He's also a novelist, and a very good one at that. He's written two books, of course, Mensch being the first, where he looks at the way German football is really produced and the youth system and how we see development, to his new book, which we do talk a lot about in this one, being Soul, and how in the pursuit for victory, we sometimes lose our soul and become less of the person that we want to be and someone that we can't really look ourselves in the mirror. I had a fantastic chat with Jonathan. We go through the novel, the new book, Soul, as well as talking about just general life things and how he got into football media. So sit back and relax, and I hope you enjoy our conversation. Well, Jonathan, thank you for taking the time to chat with us. First of all, how are you doing?
I'm well, Matt. How are you?
I'm great. It's about to tick to six in the morning on a Saturday, but honestly, I would rather be nowhere else but here. It's a little bit nippy, but honestly, it's fantastic. Adelaide's great. And yeah, really excited to actually chat with you about many things within sport, your latest book, Soul, which we will definitely dive into. And just as an advertisement, this is also not paid advertising, but if you do want to buy the book Soul from Oakley Books or anywhere that sells this book, you should definitely do it. It's only £12 UK pricing. That is more than affordable. So thought I'd break the ice to start with. You've interviewed so many interesting people throughout. So who's one person, maybe within sport or outside of sport or both, that you'd love to interview?
That's a great question. I think it's a sort of a two-headed question. When I think about people outside of sport, I think about people inside sport. I think inside sport, I would probably love to interview Colin Kaepernick. Still sort of a hero for me. Obviously, for people who don't know, I'm a San Francisco 49ers fan, so there's a connection there on the field, but I have so much respect for what he did off the field, effectively sacrificing his own career. I'd love to sit down and be able to talk to him about how he's gone through all of that and how he's experienced it. I mean, off the field, that's a good question. I mean, there are so many people outside of sport. I think of a lot of musicians or artists. Maybe someone like Donald Glover. That would be kind of cool. You know, nice. Someone who's such an inspiration across so many different platforms or modes, I guess. That would be cool as well.
Yeah, that's a good one. I really like that one, especially for his stuff in Community. And of course, the show is Atlanta. We get that on SBS here, and sometimes when it's available, I definitely tune in. That dude is multi-talented, and yes. It's funny, we're talking off air about how certain people happen to have everything, and it reminded me of your interview with Kevin Trapp, for example, as someone who essentially has everything, but of course, as a footballer, he's quite fantastic, as we can see at the time of recording this. Frankfurt are one leg away from destiny with the Europa League final.
Yeah, I mean, he was such a humble guy. That's what struck me when I had the chance to talk to him. It was really, you know, a fantastic opportunity to sit down with a goalkeeper who, ironically, and I sort of said this at the time, on my year abroad in Germany when I was studying German, I was not far from Kaiserslautern, so I ended up seeing him as a late teenager playing goal for Kaiserslautern. You know, fast forward over 10 years, and we're the same age, basically. So I'm sitting down with him before he's going into Europa League final. I'm like, Kevin, mate, it's been a journey for me as much as it's been for you. You know? So that was a really nice moment. But he definitely has, he has a lot to offer on and off the field. He seems like an extremely smart man who's very proactive about his life after football. I think he's already aware that he's approaching that stage, and have a lot of respect for someone who can still perform at a high level, but is also doing something to prepare for after football.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite fascinating because it reminds me of an earlier chat I had with Alexander Balmion, who obviously played in the Bundesliga with Bayern Munich, Borussia Mönchengladbach and Schalke. who's currently in Australia as a free agent, unfortunately. And it reminded me of a conversation we were having where he was getting ready to sort of progress into the next phase of his career post-football, and he seems pretty settled in Australia, and it's actually quite interesting to see what he will try and do going forward. I do want to bring it back, though. Let's go back to the beginning. Let's run it back. Where did your influence of sport begin? Because we all have our little origin story of how we first fell in love with a sport, whether it be footy or football or basketball or whatever. Where did it begin for you?
Well, I think it depends on the sport. I was very fortunate at a young age to have played sport. My dad played top level rugby before it was a pro sport, so I've always been interested in that. I played rugby, I played football, I played cricket at school, played all sports. But each sort of interest in sport has its own story, you know. I think over the years, a bit like most things in life, you start to realize that you enjoy some things more than others, and so you start to pursue them more than others. And like a lot of young people, you know, when you like sport, you try to think of ways in which you can stay in it for as long as possible. And like a lot of young people, I realized I was never going to make it professionally. And so when you realize that that's going to happen, you try to stay involved somehow. Football was always there. You know, I have so many memories of watching games across Europe and across Germany. I think it's always been there for me. But once I realized that I wanted to be in sport in some capacity, it was sort of a combination of writing, which I've always enjoyed doing, and football. And then because I had lived in German-speaking countries when I was younger, the connection to a language was already in place. So sort of the three things fell together, and yeah, the rest is history, I guess.
It is amazing, though, because in many ways that has helped you shape into the magnificent journalist and reporter that you are for the Deutsche Welle, of course, as well as The Athletic, which happened this year. I guess I should ask, how did that come about? Because obviously the big Bundesliga reporter cover of The Athletic is Raphael Honigstein, but he's currently helping a certain new Austrian manager, national team manager Ralf Rangnick, with some much needed PR. How did that opportunity come about for you?
Well, basically as a result of Rafa moving into that consultancy role with Ralf Rangnick, The Athletic got in touch, which I was very flattered by. I wasn't expecting it. But, you know, they wanted to continue their German football coverage, and they asked me if I felt like I could help out in the short term there while Rafa was away. And yeah, like I said, very flattered to be asked. It's been a really exciting opportunity so far. I've really enjoyed having the chance to speak to people like Kevin, like you said earlier. Not something that you get to do every day. So one of my favorite pieces for them was traveling to the hometown of Jurgen Klopp and Thomas Tuchel. So they're two different places, but they're quite close together, and yet they're also very different. And that was very cool, like meeting people and seeing the origin stories of people who are very famous. And one of the funniest things was that when I was in Klopp's hometown, I spoke to the mayor there, and he said, "You're the first person from international press come here and speak, and that can speak German." And I thought, "Oh, that's interesting." And I said, "So you've had a lot of visitors over the last few years?" And he said, "Oh, yes, this is Klopp City now." And you're talking about a hamlet, you know, there's like 300, 400 people living there. So yeah, it's been great to have some opportunities like that to go alongside the work I do with DW. It's been really exciting.
It's interesting you mentioned that conversation with the mayor and the importance of knowing a secondary language. Do you think that's really important for those who want to work in sort of a media type field to have sort of a diverse range of language?
Yeah, definitely. I think I know I wouldn't have the job I have today if I couldn't speak a language. That it happened to be German happened to work out for me because Germany won the World Cup. I think, you know, my career doesn't go the way that it does if Mario Götze doesn't score that goal. But I've spoken to a lot of people over the years about that. And I think that's ultimately the one thing I would say study a language, study two languages, because I never necessarily knew what I was going to end up doing, but I knew that I wanted to use the language skills that I had, and I knew I wanted to live in a different country. And I think you open up so many possibilities for yourself if you can speak another language, whichever one it is. And I also just think it's so exciting to go somewhere that is maybe not your home, but to put yourself in a situation where you can feel a connection to different people as a result of something that you have worked hard at learning at. So language of, for me, was absolutely at the heart of it. And I think it's I think in the English language speaking world, I think it's also a question of respect to a certain degree. I think a lot of the time English people who speak English, there's subconsciously or consciously, there's always a case of, well, do I need to? Probably most people speak English anyway. But I think if we make the effort, not only do we find a connection that we probably wouldn't have had otherwise, but also I think people just appreciate it more.
Yeah, I mean, you're going into someone else's nation, into someone else's backyard. I think it's the least one can do. Like, for example, we're talking off air about the hopes and of that eventually that I'll make my way to Germany. It's been a place that personally I've earmarked as for a long time that I've actually wanted to go and see, whether it was to travel or to work or whatever the capacity. And now more than ever, with some of the great people that I've got to meet through video call, you know, with some of the work that I've done, it's become more and more of a, well, it's not that you should come to Germany, it's you have to come to Germany. And it's not a, it's not a case of if but when, but certainly it's something that I've tried to work in, is learn the German language, even if it's just a base level, so that they can at least get me by until I obviously say something I shouldn't have said. So that's just very, very possible. We've talked about the kinds of people you've interviewed with DW, The Athletic, and other publications, including your novels, which we'll talk about in a moment. Is there one interview that stood out to you throughout the journey?
That's tricky. I don't want to give one of those traditional footballer answers, you know, to make you feel like, you know, oh, there's just the 3 points and whatever the head coach says. No. It's hard. I think there are a couple of moments which I probably think about very fondly because they were quite formative along the way of learning how to do interviews. I think when I interviewed Julian Weigl after his first really successful season at Dortmund, that felt like quite a large learning curve for me, just in terms of the process, but also having done that piece, the camera as well. You know, I felt like I was learning something on another level at that point. But also just sort of more unexpected opportunities over the years, I guess. I mean, I've done some work for 442 in the past, and years ago, I had the opportunity to speak to Christian Pulisic before anybody really knew who he was. That when you look back on that and who he is now, he's almost certainly a different person, but so am I. And so I think sometimes you sort of reflect on those interviews along the way. I think there are a lot of people I would love to have spoken to and had more of an opportunity to speak to during their careers, to sit down and spend more time with. But, you know, journalism is a very competitive field, so it's not always that simple. But when I think about specific examples, like I say, I think every time I've had interviews like that, I always think that they accompany me at a certain stage, or they've accompanied me at a certain stage of my development. So, yeah, right now, fresh in my mind is the fact that I spoke to Kevin Trapp this week. So I feel like that was a really exciting moment and a really important interview. But, you know, if we'd spoken 2 or 3 weeks ago, probably would have said someone else. And I think it's because I try to make sure that when I do interviews with people, that interview is very much the thing I'm thinking about most in the moment. And I'm not trying to think about who I've interviewed in the past or whatever, you know, just try to use the experience that I've had to be genuine and be authentic, because I think people notice if you try to be otherwise. And it's also just not in my character.
Interesting. Let's make a jump to your latest book, Soul, Beyond the Athlete. This is your second book after the brilliant Mensch, Beyond the Cones. What was the inspiration behind this book?
Well, thank you for those kind words. The inspiration behind the book was actually at the end of Mensch, I asked myself the question, I kept asking myself one question. I think there's something left over here. I haven't quite got to the end of it. And it was ultimately, does professional sport care about people? And I kept thinking that it didn't. I kept seeing examples of that not being the case. So I thought there must be people out there that are bucking this trend, that are fighting against the system that isn't necessarily in favor of a holistic development. And there were, and I definitely didn't speak to all of them. And I think there are lots of people out there who are not part of Soul, who are doing good work. But I was very fortunate just before the pandemic to spend some time in Scandinavia and see some people actually on the ground do some work there. And then ever since then, just have a phenomenal number of phone calls and video calls with people around the world who are doing this work. And I started to put together a few ideas and consider what I thought about it myself, having spoken to so many people. But ultimately, I felt like we'd come to a point in professional sport where I think athletes were taking greater ownership over their own lives. And so things were sort of changing. And I feel like athletes were not okay with just being part of a system anymore. I think they wanted to be considered a person and not a product. And I wanted to discuss that. But ultimately, I also wanted to start a conversation that would hopefully lead to change, because, you know, it's all well and good to write about something you think is important, but I think it's also necessary to put solutions down on a piece of paper and say, look, we can talk about this being something we need to change, but how do we change it? And I've tried my best through the help and the ideas and the work, ultimately, that so many people are doing to do that in this piece of work.
It is a magnificent book and very much well worth the price of admission. You mentioned a lot of the people that you interviewed from your time within Scandinavia through video calls. One that really stands to mind for me is the Oakland Roots, who are very similar to a club that we are both familiar with in Germany, FC St. Pauli, a team that really embodies and embraces the city and its multiculturalism and its diversity. I'm fascinated. In those conversations with, say, the Roots, for example, what was one of the things that you learned from talking to the people from there?
Wow. I mean, it was a fantastic conversation. You're right to say that. I think I realized, ironically, that it's funny that this is what European football used to be like. It's not like this anymore across the board. In many cases, unfortunately, okay, St. Pauli is a great example of a club that has managed to retain that. But, you know, it used to be about community. It used to genuinely be about that, not in a marketable sense or in a sense that could be monetized. But in a genuine sense, you were representing your community, and everything that was involved with the game in some way was a reflection of or connected to the people that lived in that place. And it was very refreshing to hear Oakland talk about the way that they've never lost their roots, haha. Mm-hmm. But that they've built a model off that. You know, yeah, okay, it's a professional sports team, so of course there's an element of business to it. But at the same time, I never felt like they had done it in a way that felt manipulative or exploitative. You know, they try to make sure that at their games, local artists, local musicians, local vendors, local people are involved in that process. And I have a lot of respect for that, because it's not just putting words forth and saying this is what we're going to do. It's actually putting actions as well. And I had a lot of respect for that, because ultimately, you know, it takes a village to do anything. You know, that's the reason the expression is there. And I think if you look after people around you, then they look after you.
It is quite interesting, because as we see in professional sports, teams having this really kind of one-way approach of, well, if we have high performance within the sporting context, then it doesn't, whatever happens afterwards isn't really as relevant. And what we see is that players in particular and the people within the system are really, you know, the system fails them to a massive extent, because all we see them is, for example, and this is an example in the book, is that players who make the first team, that is the byproduct, is that we train them to be professional athletes to make the first team or to be a professional athlete. But what we lose in all of that is the personal development side, especially when you look at English academies are a great example of they're factories of churning out many, many players, and only a minute percent will actually get to play professional football at the highest level. So how does, I know there's some great clubs, especially in Scandinavia, that are working towards building, not only, moving away from the current system and building a foundation where the player, the individual, the person comes first. Once you've got the person, the player comes with it. What do you think would be an apt solution for, say, English football, to really combat? I know this is a bit of a long way question. How do you reckon English football could sort of combat the issue that it currently has, where it really builds up the expectations of young footballers for them to end up with nothing?
Well, I'm concerned because I don't know whether it's possible in England anymore. I feel like we may have gone too far. I think that's kind of my biggest concern. But I think we'd have to start by not scouting children as young as 9. I think that would be a good start. I think the second thing we need to do is hand over more autonomy to children, because I think part of the reason that so many young people don't make it in professional sport is not only because only the few can make it by the nature of percentages, but also because the fun is effectively taken out of it for them. And you hear it in a lot of examples of young professionals who say, "Yeah, I really enjoyed playing this sport until I realized I had to be a professional and that people would hound me if I performed badly, and training was brutal." And you're talking to a 13-year-old. And I think there's a real danger here of getting excited about the one or two players who come through the academy and make the first team. Mark O'Sullivan, whose work at AIK with James Vaughan and Dennis Horton there, really fantastic. He always used this fantastic expression, which was, if you put a bag, if you put eggs in a bag and one of them is hardboard and you throw them against the wall, all of them will break, but you take out the one that's hardboard and you say, "Look, the system works." And that's kind of exactly what's happening in academy football. I mean, one player makes it through, everyone gets excited, but we don't see all of the, effectively, and this is another quote that we were talking about in the book, the dead bodies that are left behind. And I know that's quite a severe expression, but really, we are talking about a lot of young people who only see themselves as footballers, and so there is a death of identity there that does need to get acknowledged and looked after. Crystal Palace have done some really interesting work recently in talking about post-academy care, how to help people in that space. I think there are clubs who are recognizing that this work needs to be done, and I ultimately think the reason for that is because it's a win-win for both people, right? If you look after the person, you're not only making sure that you avoid soulless or broken people leaving your academy, whether they become professionals or not, but you're also effectively cementing your legacy as a club, because if that person leaves and goes on to be an electrician, a baker, a professor, whatever it is, they will always say, "God, that time at that club was fantastic, and they always looked after me." And that is the kind of, legacy that is priceless, really. So I would hope that more clubs would look at that and say, "Okay, maybe our line here, when does our care of responsibility stop and when does it begin? Okay, but maybe it never stops once they come into our system until they have found themselves in another place and they're on their feet." I think that's something that they have to do a better job at. I mean, there are other examples. I think the work being done, say, at Nordjylland, where they have character development built into the club, I love that approach. I think it works really well. I would love to see that in more places. But my concern is whether there's even space for that inside a system like England's, where unfortunately you're scouting as young as 9 already. And so the conversation about people is not even a starter.
Yeah, and I think and this talk about people, and imagine like being your entire life is invested into football. I want to be a professional footballer. You go through all the academy system only to be churned out and cut at a short's notice. As a particular individual, your entire life has been devoted to one cause. And this is where the case of soullessness really comes into effect, because you've lost essentially any semblance of your own identity. And then basically you go through the next portion of your life searching for yourself once again. And that kind of difficulty of because it happens a lot here in Australia where, you know, a lot of players want to be, wants to play AFL footy, for example. Great example of, you know, there are now 18 AFL clubs with 40 odd players on a list. And then you got the second tier, which is the, like the VFL, the Sandfall, the Waffle. And then it's just amateur footy underneath that. And there are a lot of kids that will go through an academy system through this, like here in South Australia, it's the Sandfall, where they are chucked into regions where, you know, they get recruited, they can go through the system. And actually a good example of this is my brother who went out to North Adelaide as a U13, and that's where they start as the youngest, was part of there to the U16, and then he got hurt. And all he wanted to do was play footy. And as one brother does, as you know, you say, look, you need to look at other avenues, because if it doesn't work out, and to be honest, already had my doubts anyway, if it doesn't happen, you need to have another option. And some questionable influences on his life made him to continue to pursue. So he went to another club at U18, and he got him hurt immediately. Like first or second training session, he gets hurt and the club is like, you need to play footy before we can reconsider you. No one reconsidered him. And he lost, in my opinion, he lost a semblance of who he was, because he was always told in many respects that, well, this is the life for you. You should do this. This is the direction you need to go in. Footy is for you. And he was ultimately playing footy, but with no purpose. He lost the purpose to play footy. He lost playing footy. He bounced from club to club and eventually settled at an old collegians club where he's accepted where he is at with life, where he's now got a job, recently married, just had a daughter. You know, and that's changed the perspective of his life. And also, but that's part of the system. The system is designed to only have the top 1% make it, and the other 99% are kind of cast astray, unless you are either self-aware of the situation or you have someone in your ear telling you other options. You need other options to succeed. And eventually, you know, he didn't really listen to me, but you know, as brothers do, as brothers do. I guess one question I do want to ask about the writing of the books after a bit of self-indulgence was there any person that you interviewed that challenged your own beliefs regarding personal development and sport?
I think everybody, if I'm honest. I think when I went into writing the book, I thought I had all these grand ideas about how it would work, or how I thought it should work. And I realized very quickly that there's a big difference between having ideas in theory and then seeing them in practice and speaking to people and having the opportunity to, yeah, try out ideas with athletes and see what clubs thought, but also speaking to them about how they did it made me realize that there's so many other things to take into consideration. You know, the bottom line is, if you think personal development is good, having a moral stance on thinking it's just the right thing to do is not enough, because ultimately, they are professional organizations, and for the most part, they're businesses. So you have to be able to convince people in a boardroom that this is necessary, and what is the best way to do that is by convincing them that this will lead to a performance increase. So the greatest irony, of course, is that you have to approach it by putting the one thing on the table that you're not interested in, which is performance, because ultimately that's the measurement in which we were just discussing. Too many athletes are measured by, you either perform or you don't, and if you don't, you're out. And this work is absolutely not about performance. This work is about making sure that everything to do with the person is well balanced on an even keel, and that they are where they need to be so that the performance can increase. But that's a byproduct, not an aim. And so that's the greatest struggle, I think. If you're trying to convince people at the top, you have to approach it quite forthright and say, look, I promise you that if we do this, you will get a better performance on the field and you will have a better product to sell. I will never talk about that in my work, or the way we approach this as a club will not be about that. But if you don't do this, you will have to deal with the performance increase that you missed out on taking a chance on, but also all of the repair costs that you will have to deal with on the back end. And that's something I really hope that clubs and organizations start to do more of, is that they're more proactive about this stuff. You know, you were just talking there about your brother. I think if clubs take a more proactive approach and say, okay, you're 16, 17, what kind of player are you? Okay, you're a creative player. Does that mean you like to be creative in other spaces? Maybe there's a yes there. Maybe there are other fields in which that creativity can come to light, whether that's art or music or whatever it is. Give people the opportunity to explore other parts of their identity, so that whether it works out in professional sport or not, they are a more rounded individual who is more aware of who they are. Because if it works out in professional sport and they do have this other part, then they're not just spending Monday to Friday worrying about how they performed on Saturday. They are doing other things, and that's healthy and important. And if it doesn't work out in professional sport, they already are aware of who they are outside of the identity of being an athlete. So it's a win-win situation, I think.
Yeah, absolutely tend to agree. And also, if you are one of the 1% who has made it at a professional level, but also is that well-rounded human being, your path outside of the game, once you decide to retire and move on, whether you decide to stay within sport, as we see with a lot of athletes, whether they go into coaching or management roles or they become player agents, you know, at least they have that vested interest. And it reminds me of current situation that's happening in the NBA. There's a lot of talk about Ben Simmons, of course, who hasn't played for all the entirety of the season. He's seen his Brooklyn Nets get swept by the Celtics. And I'm always interested about what past players tend to say about this. So you look at like the NBA on TNT, for example. So you got Shaq, Kenny, and Chuck with the EJ, the Hall of Fame crew, as they are, and they always seem to dig in on Ben. There's obviously public perception here in Australia because he didn't play for Australia in the Olympics.
Yeah,
for his personal reasons, and we have to respect those reasons. It is quite fascinating because especially Chuck and Shaq in particular, because they, you know, all of them played in the 90s and it was a bit different back then. You had to play hurt. And it's quite interesting how they talk about how he quit on his new team, a team that he's never played for because he's been injured with back injuries and all that kind of stuff. But I can't imagine how difficult his personal development has turned into, where clearly he has vested interests outside of the game, but people within that inner circle, we see this in football as well, tell you that, well, you have to play hurt. You have to give more than 110%. And it creates this really kind of rank environment where it doesn't matter. Personal development doesn't matter. It's all about results. And that's the unfortunate part of the industry.
It is. And you're right. You're right. And I think the NBA example is a very poignant one, a very apt one, especially off the back of the Jordan documentary, which, you know, for the sake of argument here, is definitely not a documentary, because Michael Jordan had to sign off on that. And if you have to sign off on anything that you're in, it's by definition not a documentary. But, you know, the interesting thing about that is that you can quite clearly see, and the line that always sticks with me is this concept of, if I had to make people uncomfortable and I had to be nasty or I had to be, you know, not likable, as it were, then I was willing to do that. And I just fundamentally disagree that to be successful in sport, you have to be that way. But I think it's such a easy concept for people to fall in love with, because, of course, you want to think that the guy who's obsessed, who's willing to be uncomfortable with other people, is the model for how we need to approach, how we should view the ultimate sports star. Well, that's not true. Everyone is different. People work on different levels. People work in different ways. Some people have different diets. Some people sleep 4 hours. Some people sleep 12, you know, and I think everyone has the right way that works for them. And so long as that isn't damaging for themselves or the people around them or the team, then that needs to be respected. And yeah, it is a strange environment in which this sort of obsession with obsession, you know, the idea of the process, I also find extremely damaging in some respects, because I obviously think that people in any environment should look to improve on themselves. I think that's human nature. We want to be better people. We also want to be better at our jobs. You know, that's normal. But I think in professional sport, we've reached a point now where if you think about what we're actually doing by telling someone to turn up and be better tomorrow, we're telling them for 15 years that they're not good enough today. And that's something that is also kind of damaging, because at the end of that career, as we were just talking about, when you wake up one day and you're not trying to get better in the gym, look at Tom Brady. I obviously one of the greatest players in the NFL, probably the greatest player to ever play the sport. I think he's got a massive problem. And the problem is that he's addicted to football. Mm. He's addicted to waking up every August and starting OTAs and training camp. Like, I don't think he can do life outside of that schedule. And I think that's sad because he's got a family.
Yeah.
I would love to see him spend more time with his family. You know, he retired. He retired. And he unretired. And you know what's funny? Two things. He retired, he never said the word retired mm-hmm. when he retired. And secondly, when he unretired, he came back and said, I have unfinished business. I'm sorry, you have unfinished business. You have 7 Super Bowls. You have almost every single record in the game. What unfinished business are you talking about, Tom? And the only unfinished business about that, and you know, is that you aren't finished with the game. And for me, that's sad, because you should be. There's a whole lot more of your life out there to live. And, you know, it's not my place to tell Tom Brady what to do. He probably doesn't even, he definitely doesn't even care what I think anyway. But what I'm saying is, isn't that so interesting that the person that's perhaps on the pedestal in this sport, and perhaps even across many sports, is also an example of someone who I think has gone to an extreme by his own admission in his documentary, Man in the Arena. He says, I have gone to an extreme level. Mm. You know, he acknowledges that. And that's not good. I don't think we want people that way, because we're also then losing the human. And I think if you and I are watching sport, I want to have a feeling that that guy could have gone to school with me, that that guy could have been on a team against me, that that guy could have played down the road. I don't want to think, that guy's been in an academy for 15 years and he's been lifting weights since he was 12. I don't want that feeling, because then it's literally so far removed from something that I can relate to. And that's not to say, look, they can play in a different country, they can speak a different language, they can play, be in a different culture, absolutely. But there's got to be some level of human connection there. And if all we're seeing are these gladiators who are sacrificing their bodies every day, that's not the sport that I would like to see in the future.
And you can't help, in a weird way, you can't help but not feel a bit sorry for some of them, because they've risen to such a high level, or they're on such a distinguished pedestal comparative to everyone else. They can't really live such a life of normality, because no matter where they go, whether it's on the street, they go to a bar or something, people know who they are, and they're always trying to get into the, I call it the personal space, get in that vicinity that, you know, leave them alone. I'm reminded of a story that a few years ago, an ex-AFL footballer was in a lift with me. David Neitz, played for the Melbourne Footy Club, legendary guy. And he was, you know, it was like late at night and I was going back to my hotel room. And I've always told this story to a few people who would always say, well, why didn't you get a picture with him? Why didn't you talk to him? Why didn't you do this? I'm like, that's, why? He's a normal person. Leave him alone. He's doing his own thing. He may have had company, but overall, let him do his thing. It's hard enough for a professional athlete to walk down the street without people annoying him. If I've got him cornered in a lift, like, can I? I wasn't even worried about that situation where it's like he's just a normal guy. He's a retired athlete who yeah. is doing his own things and he's living his own life. And for athletes, that can, I think that's very, very difficult, where, you know, we see it a lot with guys like LeBron, where people try and get him and he'll duck. He'll just dip. I don't want to deal with it. I want to avoid it. And people get pissy about that. It's like, what does he owe you? What do players, what do athletes, coaches, what do they owe you? You already, you know, sure, they make millions and millions of dollars through endorsements and their contracts and stuff like that. But what do they owe you? They're not just your form of entertainment on call. These are people. And we, I think as a society, we do forget this at the best of times. And it creates, we've created such, I think in sport, we've created such a really poor dynamic where we can't distinguish these as people. Lewis Hamilton's a great example of this, right? He does a lot of things outside of Formula One, and obviously he's had a tough start to this season, and people were talking about retirement. He's not got the passion for it. It's like, isn't it healthy that, you know, yes, he wants to win. That's obvious, and he's done that. He's from race one, he's been in a position to win with McLaren and Mercedes. But isn't it great that he has perspective outside of the racetrack, that he helps, you know, less fortunate people or people of color get into industries like fashion, for example, doing that fashion show of just all minority individuals? Like, how great is that? Like, he is willing to invest time in the people to help them get to where they want to go. And why isn't that a story? Instead of us talking about how, you know, as much as it's results driven, we always talk about, well, it sounded like he's fighting with his team, and this is happening in every ex racer. Obviously, Nico Rosberg is one of them who's chimed in. And as much as, you know, we all wait, I think this is another thing. We all wait for people to get to the top. We cheer them to the top, and then we all wait for them to fall. That's the next thing, right? Is that we just want them to lose.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the nature of great storytelling, even if you go back to the really early concepts of it, you know, what makes a great story? You know, you find out about an individual, you see their rise, you see their, you know, elevation to a certain point, and then you see their fall. And then there's a message or a lesson that comes as that, as a result of the whole story. And so perhaps it's just ingrained in us as a society to want to see the rise and the fall of individuals. I think when you look at the way that certain things have gone for certain people, people love the concept of a rise, a fall, and a rise again. You know, if you look at Tiger Woods winning that major after all of those things in between, but yet again, there's another example of an individual I would love to have seen win way fewer majors and be a much healthier human, having looked after himself more, having not had to suffer as a result of his relationship with his father, and also then not having done damage to so many other people as a result. And I, you know, those are the situations where we have to sit back and say, what's happening here? There's been a sacrifice, which is effectively Tiger Woods, the person. And the gain has been what basically, you know, modern golf is still feeding itself off. And so, and that's just one example that you can find thousands of others that are very similar. So I think really that's the core of it for me. I would like to see not just way less, but nobody sacrificed.
Yep.
Even if it means a drop in quality, just because I want people who play sport to also have a life after sport. I mean, I know you're also an NFL fan, and we've talked about this off air many times. And I know you've not had an easy few years as a Vikings fan. But, you know, when I saw the draft recently, just yesterday, it blows my mind that we're still living in this age where we're so close to real life looking like a video game. Yeah. When these guys get drafted, these statistics come up and it's like rated out of 100, like the video game. And I'm like, who is making this adjustment? Who's making these decisions to make me feel? And I don't even, I mean, I watch some college football, but some of these guys coming through, I don't know anything about them. So then I'm like, I'm seeing something like athleticism 90. What does that mean? What does that really mean? And the worst part is when it says personality 85. Personality 85? Get me one of those, please. You know, like, I don't, and I think that's scary because we start to, whether we want to or not, we start to move into this space where, if you think about how people of our generation got into sport, well, it was probably because we went with friends or because our family or brother or dad took us to games, right? So our access is through live sport. I think a lot of younger people still have that right now, but there are also a lot of young people who are accessing games through video games or through new technology, maybe even like NFTs. You know, there are other ways in which to access that, which means that the perception is drastically different. And so therefore you have to work harder to make sure the divide is clear. Otherwise, what's to stop the merging of the two things where you're effectively saying, God, you know, Trent Alexander's crossing on FIFA 22 is 93, and I'm watching him on a Tuesday night, and why isn't his crossing really good? Because his crossing's 93 on FIFA. What is happening here? We've effectively gone so far around the other way that the video game, the virtual reality, is impacting the real world. And that, for me, is where we lose all perception of the person.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think that's already very much in effect, as we know. It was interesting because I had the draft in the background while I was doing some work, and the thing that always gets me is the reaction to what is essentially climbing the mountain. The one that really stood out to me was Kenny Pickett, who went to the University of Pittsburgh. Everyone loved it, and you could see that everyone's gone nuts in the background, and he's like, it's almost like the journey is partially over.
Mm.
I've reached the summit. Hands in his head. And he's the only one who's not really looking at anything. He's just clenched. And the camera's panning in on his hair and his long wavy hair, and it's all great. The one with the smallest hands in the, you know, as a quarterback and all this kind of stuff. And some will say this is just the beginning of the Kenny Pickett story, but is this also, in many ways, the end of Kenny Pickett the person? Because his entire life now, for the next 5 years guaranteed in terms of contract money, is that he is now a devoted football player. The grind, as they call it, ridiculous... The 12-hour days, the long study, the gym, all this thing he's got to study, the massive book playbook to be QB1, essentially. And we will probably lose Kenny the person along the way as he eventually is developed into a high-performance elite athlete. And then what do we have at the end of it? As we know, the NFL is huge for concussion injuries and players who have significantly worse quality of life. They were showing Booger McFarlane, and half his fingers, his left fingers on ESPN, were just completely mangled. Like, he's got left fingers going this way and that way. And as a sport, like as an industry, that's part of our failing, is that we don't take care of the person because we're so all about performance, results. It's all about winning. Win at all costs. It doesn't matter if you have to completely turn yourself into a vegetable at the end of it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's sad. That's tragic. There are so many players and athletes who go through life with such a poor quality of life now because of things that weren't addressed back in the time. And concussion's a big one we talk about in football in particular. And every time there's a concussion injury in German football, we're on it straight away. We're like, why isn't there some sort of protocol? Why are they only given 2-3 minutes to rush this player on? Do we know that there are things called, you know, post concussion, like things that there's a delay. Sometimes there's a delay. I'm not speaking particularly well here, but the point I'm trying to say is that by letting it sit and just letting him play, he or she concussed, we have a problem down the line where these individuals will lose themselves. And this is where, you know, I think studies have shown that dementia can be caused from many head injuries. And it is quite fascinating that we still haven't got a process in place to help with concussion. I don't understand it.
I mean, that's a reinforcement of what you've been saying. I mean, that's an excellent point that we've actually, you know, we've reached a moment in professional sport where we're willing to effectively just create a pile of skeletons for the sake of our own entertainment. And I think that is dramatic. It's damning. And yet it's also damning that we have probably not asked this question. This is not the first time we're asking this question. You know, we've been in this situation many times before. I'd love to see independent medical teams rather than team-based medical teams, because that's not a reflection on the quality of club-based medical teams, but I think that the dynamics make it very difficult for that situation to go as it should. I'm not a doctor, so I'm not going to sit here and make diagnoses, absolutely. But I think the pressure on individuals as a result of the system trickling down, we have to win this game, therefore this player gets injured, he's really important, therefore can he play for 10 minutes? Not really, can he? He wants to, okay, get him on. You know, in the short term, I think people are questioning that more and more now. But it's also difficult for the player because, as you mentioned earlier on in the show, goes against norms. People expect you to be physical and to fight through pain. You know, the Terry Butcher picture everyone loves to look at where he's bleeding through his forehead. Everyone loves that idea of being, you know, he was determined, he was hard, he, you know, wanted to go through it. Or how about we just create a situation where people are like, no, I'm injured, I'm going to come off, you know, and let's be smart about it. Yeah. But you're right. I think it's such a great point to make with Pickett that he's so excited about what comes next. But in fact, there's probably also something that's sort of fading away there in that process. And you know how many people, when they have those interviews on stage afterwards, my favorite part of the draft is always the hug with Roger Goodell. Like those are hugs I think every person needs once a day. Those are great hugs. If you haven't seen them, go watch the commissioner of the NFL hug people when they have literally just achieved their dreams. It's kind of magical. But almost every one of them says, I'm ready to get to work. It's like the process has already begun the moment they're on the stage. And I get it, you know, you want to get better, you want to learn, absolutely. But I sort of think, wow, enjoy this moment. If you can't enjoy this moment, what, you know, has that person already left? You know, is there just nothing left? Because you've literally, as you said, gone to and reached this point that so many people want to and so many people don't. You are a professional football player at the peak of their professionalism in some senses because you've just been drafted by an NFL team. You get to play in probably the most expensive league in the world in terms of revenue, right? Like, and play for esteemed franchises, maybe other than Jacksonville. And just, you know, amazing. And I'm like, can't you guys enjoy it? And it just feels like they can't because they're part of this system. You know, like we were saying earlier, they still feel like, I've got to deliver. I've got to be better. And I'm like, guys, just worry about that tomorrow. Just enjoy now, you know?
Yeah. It is that lack of living in the moment. And like you just got drafted. Your world is going to change quite drastically.
Changing right now.
Yeah, exactly. Like you haven't even set foot in the practice facilities yet. You are just live. I think that's the thing. And it's a good really mantra to live for in sport, definitely. But also in life is that, you know, we're so focused, and I'm guilty of this too, looking forward to what's going to happen in the future. And, you know, but we don't, at a sacrifice, we don't actually enjoy what's happening right now. And
that's an excellent point. I think you're right. And I think it's not just a sport thing. I think it's a life thing. Absolutely. I know, and I think journalism is very bad at this as well. I think journalism is effectively, like many professions, but particularly sports journalism, what about the next byline? What about the next interview? What about the next opportunity? And, you know, I'm sure other people will speak to this, but I certainly have had to fight over the years at that. And I think I'm in a much better position at it now, but, you know, I'm still trying to get better at it. But living in the moment, and that is probably the one thing that I think I really liked about the Last Dance is that scene with Jordan before the finals where he's in the bus listening to music, because there is a man not caring about tomorrow in that situation. And I did respect, because it is so hard to do in a day-to-day basis. Like I am worrying about what I have to do next week when really I should just be relaxed and enjoying what I'm doing right now. I mean, I am. Well, I'm enjoying this very much. But you know, this process whereby we can't get rid of our to-do list or our achievement list, because I think, and this is also part of an extremely bigger conversation that we could probably have a separate pod on, but what capitalism does to individuals is make them feel like they're really only measured by their productivity. Mm-hmm. And so if you're not contributing, or you don't feel like you're achieving, whether that be by making money or achieving increase in status in your profession, then you're not contributing and therefore you don't have any value. Whereas actually one of the best things that we can do is measure our own value against how we see ourselves. So do I feel like I'm better than I was yesterday? This is not about anyone else's opinion. This is not about anyone else's measure or my professional abilities or whatever. Am I being a good person today to the people that love me, that I love? Have I been kind? Have I been compassionate? Have I been caring? Those kind of things, that's a much better measure. But it's much harder to do in a system that, as I say, is constantly trying to make you feel like you're only really about your productivity. And if you take all of that and you put it in a sports environment where millions of people are watching you do your job on a regular basis, then yeah, someone like Michael Jordan sitting in the back of the bus listening to music that other people don't have on a cassette player is amazing, because that shows a 100% willingness to just be in the situation that they're in and living their life for what it is. And that I have a lot of respect for, because, as you say, I think really we could all do a bit more of that.
100%. DW, hit us up. We want that. We want that podcast episode on that. I reckon it would be a really good vibe. Jonathan, thank you so much for your time. It was an amazing conversation. Honestly, we could talk for hours, and honestly, it would still be amazing. But I'll let you go. Thank you again for coming on.
A pleasure, Matt. Thank you so much for having me, and really, really enjoyed it.
One of my favorite interviews that I've conducted so far, and you can just tell how much of a genuine individual that Jonathan is, and it very much spills across in everything he writes, whether it's on social media for DW or of course in his books Mensch and Soul. And I know I've probably mentioned it during the podcast that you should definitely check out the books, especially if you want to develop more knowledge on those kinds of topics. They're both fantastic books. I can't highly recommend them enough, and they're at an affordable price, so do go check them out. That's it for the three-parter. Where one-on-one goes from here, we shall see, but we're certainly looking into different areas that we want to tackle. And what would you like to see on one-on-one? Who are the types of people that you'd like to be interviewed on this program? Let us know in the comment section. And thank you again for listening. I hope you have a fantastic weekend, and I'll see you soon.